Well, hello everyone, and welcome to the teleclass, Why Don't Workers Use PPE? My name is Paul Weber, and I thank you very much for joining us today. Professor David DeJoy came to my attention initially through an article in the American Journal of Infection Control. Now, that article wasn't actually his, but it referenced another article that was prepared by Professor DeJoy and his group. In fact, the referenced article was so really, it was fascinating. It was so interesting that I looked for more by this author, and I found an absolutely astounding body of work. If you have an opportunity after the teleclass, do a PubMed search for DeJoy DM and see what you find. The results are remarkable. David M. DeJoy is director and co-founder of the Workplace Health Group in the College of Public Health at the University of Georgia in Athens, Georgia. This is a multidisciplinary group that conducts research on workplace health and organizational effectiveness. And most applicably to today's presentation, one of the key research areas for Dr. DeJoy and his colleagues is finding ways to get healthcare workers to comply with safe work practices. Our speaker has received several awards, notable awards, including the prestigious Liberty Mutual Prize, which is a national award that recognizes outstanding original research in the field of occupational health and safety, and also the William A. Owens Award for an outstanding body of research in the social and behavioral sciences. Those are two of several. He serves on a variety of editorial boards, review committees, and advisory panels at the national and international level, and it is a real privilege to have him join us to give this lecture today. From the University of Georgia, I am pleased to present Professor David DeJoy.
Thank you very much. That was a wonderful introduction. I wish you could tell the people here about me. I'm a safety specialist and a behavioral scientist. That means I'm not an infection control specialist, but some of my best friends are, and I've had a long-standing interest in workplace self-protective behavior, and of course recently with the interest in pandemic flu and related issues, there's been a lot of interest in why people use or don't use personal protective equipment. So let me move on to my second slide, the slide immediately after the title slide. And this is just a little summary of what I think the problem is. And everywhere you look, everything you read pretty much points out that compliance with personal protective equipment is frequently poor. And even if it's not particularly poor, it's usually quite inconsistent. And probably the biggest thing to keep in mind about that is that PPE compliance depends on human reliability. And humans are extraordinarily resourceful, but they are not extraordinarily reliable. And when we talk about most PPE situations, what we're asking people to do is not to perform a single simple behavior, but to really perform a set of behaviors and to perform those behaviors perfectly every time those behaviors are indicated. And for most people, that's an extremely tall order. And when we think about the hazard control hierarchy, personal protective equipment is pretty much at the bottom of the list, and it's at the bottom of the list, I think, for some pretty good reasons. Unfortunately, we have situations where PPE use is unavoidable. It may be the only control strategy available, or it may be the only control strategy immediately available. So the problem is a fairly complex problem. But go to the next slide. The point I want to make here is that we need to look at the compliance process as a process, as a multi-component behavioral process. But even more than that, as a multi-component interactive behavioral process. And I think another point, particularly for in the healthcare environment, is that training is important to compliance, but it's clearly not the whole story. You know, we usually talk about training as being necessary but not sufficient. In my experience in the healthcare environment, there is an emphasis on the fact, okay, we train people and problem solved. Or if we have a problem, we train people and to solve the problem. And I think in PPE, which in the abstract seems very simple, it's actually much more complex than that. And regardless of how good your PPE technology is, ultimately the problem is a behavioral problem. It's getting people to do something, and to do something all the time and do it right all the time, and generally to do something they really don't want to do for a variety of different reasons. Going to the next slide, this slide is titled Unpacking the Compliance Process. And the way I see it, there's at least five sets of factors, and not just five factors, but five sets of factors that need to be looked at in any application of personal protective equipment in really just about any work environment where they are indicated. And generally, if we look at these five components from a systems point of view, from an interactive systems point of view, we need to keep in mind that compliance is probably only going to be as good as the weakest of those five components. If we think about those five components as interdependent, the weakest link in that system is going to be the most important in terms of impacting compliance and safety performance. Go to the next slide. All I've tried to do here is to give you some indication of what these five sets of factors include. And usually, you know, from the infection control point of view, we're usually really concerned about the characteristics of the agent or the pathogen or the hazard involved. Then next, we're thinking about the device, the appropriateness of the device, the complexity of use, and so forth. But we also have the user factors. All the lists here are just illustrative. They're certainly not by any means exhaustive, but I think they do hit many of the variables that have been looked at in the literature, and they tap many of the issues that we have to deal with in the real-world application. So we've got these five factors influencing compliance, and each factor is really a set of variables or a set of sub-factors that need to be taken into consideration. Not all of these sub-factors are present in every situation, but there usually are multiple factors within each of these components in any situation. Okay, go to the next slide. The way that traditionally we've looked at compliance with PPE is to focus on the user. And focusing on the knowledge, the attitudes of the user, their particular tolerance or sensitivity. I've done some work with firefighters and self-contained breathing apparatus use. And some people are just simply claustrophobic, and there are ways to deal with that. But basically, individual tolerance is a factor in that particular application. Usually we think more about knowledge and attitudes. The thing I'd want to emphasize here while we're focusing on the user is that we want to think about the user as an active participant, not as a passive participant, but as an active participant, and a participant who is processing the situation and processing information, perhaps correctly, perhaps incorrectly. But they're doing that all the time, and things change. And people will often give precedence to their own subjective perceptions, even in the presence of contrary information. And those perceptions are subject to change based on a lot of factors, and quite often just on the basis of rumor and innuendo. Okay, so we've got these five sets of factors. Traditional view is to look at the user, try to understand the user as a way to maximize compliance. What I call the expanded view is probably, it's looking at the device and the user interface. And the expanded view is really probably best described as a human factors approach. You know, we're looking at the interaction between a particular piece of equipment, a particular device, in this case a PPE, and the person, and we're looking at the fit, the match, the complexity, and so forth. And that's an improvement, I think, over the traditional approach of, well, let's just train them to use it and move on. But I think it gets more complicated than that. If we go to the next slide, this is the slide that's labeled compliance and interactive view. Now, you might look at this slide and say, what we've got here is a mess. We've pretty much got everything interacting or potentially interacting with everything else. And I think that's pretty much the situation. We've got the agent, the device, the worker, the task and procedure at issue, the environment, and the organizational context. We've got these five sets of factors, and they're really all interacting with each other. And I portrayed this sort of, if you think about it from a left to right point of view, at the middle of the diagram we have the agent, and we have the PPE and the, hopefully the match there, or the PPE ensemble. And then we've got the PPE device and the worker. We think about it that way, but then we expand it on the top by looking at the work or task that's being done, and then we look at the bottom and look at the environmental organizational context. And I think in virtually any PPE application, I think a good starting point is to think about it, analyze it from the perspective of these five interacting components. And the lines connecting the components, you know, represent at least my thinking on where the primary linkages occur. But any given situation is likely to be different. And one of the things I think we see in healthcare is, you know, the work, task, or the procedure is inherently different than in other workplace settings, or I should say at least in most other workplace settings. In some situations, the work, task, or procedure might be very simple, not particularly important or challenging to deal with. That's seldom the case in healthcare. So that's the diagram for the interactive view. We can make it even a little bit more complex in the next slide, because realistically we can identify a set of, I guess I call them here, extra organizational influences. You could also call them simply external, extraneous, or exogenous influences, but they're really outside the actual application, but they have the potential to impact the entire process or at least specific elements within that process. And I just labeled three of them, policy, standards, and certification, because they are often at issue with PPE applications in healthcare settings, and certainly, of course, particularly with respiratory protection. Okay, so it's getting more complicated. I want to now sort of shift attention to talk a little bit about self-protective behavior, or workplace self-protective behavior. And this is referencing work I did a long time ago when I was a child. But there's three things here on this slide, stage or sequential model of self-protective behavior. There's three things I'd like to emphasize, and so that I would remember them myself, I put them on the bottom of the slide. And it's that self-protective behavior is an active process. And again, that goes back to one of the very earliest slides in the presentation and sort of the reminder to think about the individual as an active component, an active processor, and not a passive component. And so self-protective behavior, it's an active process. And it involves pretty much all the way along the line personal judgments of risk. And we've certainly seen this in the healthcare environment where there are a number of studies that say that, well, people use or don't use PPE quite often because of their own particular judgments of the risk of a particular situation or a particular encounter. I'm not saying that's a good thing. In some cases, it might be a good thing. In many cases, it could be a bad thing. But I do think that people do give a certain amount of emphasis to their own personal judgments of risk. And in terms of what's going on in a work environment or an organizational environment, those personal judgments of risk can change across time. They can change quite quickly across time, and those perceptions can change in the proper direction or the improper direction. And it really emphasizes the importance of the communication environment or the background noise or the background chatter within an organization or a work setting. But personal judgments of risk are important. Third factor is compliance is not a either-or process. It's really a series of stages. And these stages, they're not immutable, but they represent a very good heuristic to keep in mind. I mean, people are confronted with a hazard. They make an appraisal of that hazard using the information that's available and cues in the environment that are available. They make a decision. They initiate a behavior, and they continue, maintain, or adhere to that behavior, or they don't adhere to that behavior. Some of the factors that influence initiation are relatively unimportant in terms of long-term adherence. But I think it's useful, it's helpful to think about the compliance process from a stage perspective. And I know stage perspectives seem to be important in everything today, but I think from a self-protective behavior perspective, I think stage model is the way to go. If we look at the stages a little bit more carefully, we can try to identify the factors. I'm on the slide that says stages and constructs of self-protective behavior. If we look at the column called constructs, I've identified five constructs. And then across the top of the slide, we have the four stages: appraisal, decision making, initiation, and adherence. The P is my judgment of the fact that particular construct is of primary importance at that particular stage. And the S, of course, is that particular construct is of secondary importance. And I don't mean to imply that there's more precision here or exactitude than there really is. These, you know, primary, secondary, I think I can defend my labels of primary or secondary, but you know, this is a way of thinking through a PPE application. It's not a decisive formula, but threat-related beliefs are very important early in the process of self-protective behavior. And threat-related beliefs are primarily severity, perceived severity, and perceived likelihood. And thinking about those two factors in kind of a multiplicative situation, if the severity is very, very high, well, the likelihood can be very, very low, but we've still got people's attention. And the exact opposite would be, well, the severity is very, very mild. It doesn't necessarily matter how likely it is. It doesn't really matter. So those, think about severity and likelihood interacting multiplicatively. Response efficacy are people's perceptions or beliefs about the effectiveness of whatever they're being asked to do. You know, will wearing a respirator make a difference? Will not walking under a ladder, you know, save me from bad luck? I mean, it's will the action make a difference? And at the appraisal stage, perceptions about response efficacy are very important. You know, you can scare the heck out of people in terms of threat, but if you don't give them a reasonable response alternatives, you're not necessarily going to move them along in the process of self-protection. Third construct is self-efficacy, and self-efficacy can be defined a variety of different ways, but generally it refers to the individual's beliefs or perceptions about their ability to do what they're being asked to do or to do what's being indicated. For, you know, if you take an example like losing weight, a person may believe they need to lose weight, and they may think that losing weight would be a good thing, but when you ask them, do they think they can lose weight, do they think they can do what they need to lose weight, the answer might be no, and the chances of them losing weight are not very good. So perceptions about their ability to do something are important, and these perceptions of self-efficacy gain in importance in the decision-making stage, because hopefully we've given people a set of threat-related perceptions that are veridical, that are accurate. We've given them a workable response or set of responses to deal with those, and that's a big if. But they also have to weigh in whether they think they can really do that. And in many situations, people will say, well, you know, I can do it, but I can't do my job as well if I'm wearing personal protective equipment. Or in the healthcare setting, the personal protective equipment interferes with the patient-provider interaction. Well, those are really perceptions related to self-efficacy. You know, what the person's really saying is, well, yeah, I know I need to do this. I know the response, I know the action would help, but I'm just not, I don't think I can do it. I'm just not sure I'm going to be able to do it. And you can see that self-efficacy becomes important to decision-making and to initiation. Facilitating conditions is just a reminder to look at the environment, look at the context, and try to identify the factors that will make it easier to engage in the behaviors we're asking people to engage in. And I know I've been on the IOM committee that's been looking at pandemic flu and healthcare workers, and I mean that is a point I've tried to bring out anyways in sort of my part of that task, the behavioral change part. You know, make it as easy as possible to do what needs to be done. Facilitating conditions don't really have much to do at all with hazard appraisal. They become quite important in decision-making, but I would probably argue they're even more important in initiation and adherence than they are even in decision-making. People will make a decision to do something maybe with only limited consideration to facilitating conditions, simply because at that point they're just not thinking about that. It's still about them at the decision-making stage, but once we get into initiation and adherence, the facilitating conditions become very important. And also safety climate becomes very important. Safety climate, let me give you a definition of safety climate. The shared perceptions that employees have about the importance of safety within their organization. And that's pretty much a generally accepted definition. And I'm going to talk about safety climate more in a little while, so I'll just kind of leave it at that right now, but how important is safety within the organization? And that becomes very important with initiation. It becomes extremely important, I think, in terms of long-term adherence. If we want people to do something, and we want a particular behavior to become the accepted way, the established way of doing things, then the climate within the organization is going to be very, very important. And the facilitating conditions are important. I might even argue that the safety climate is actually even more important, because safety climate influences the expectations that people have about performing different behaviors in a workplace. And if we're talking about getting people to do something on a long-term basis, the safety climate can be extremely important. Let me move to the next slide. This is titled Training and Construct Stages of Self-Protective Behavior. I don't know if everybody's got a colored version of this slide or not, or whether people have black and white version, but what I've tried to do here with the rectangles within the matrix or within the chart is I've tried to talk about two different kinds of training and to try to point out that when we use knowledge-based training, we're really focusing on threat-related beliefs usually and response efficacy, and we're usually focusing on the hazard appraisal and decision-making stages. And that's certainly important to do. I think the point I want to make is that it's certainly important to do, but it's probably not enough to do. Because you can train people and you can send them off with the best of intentions and the knowledge of what they need to do, but that doesn't mean they're going to do it. Years ago, when the Universal Precaution Standard was promulgated by OSHA, I did some work with NIOSH on compliance with universal precautions in healthcare, and we knew that compliance wasn't very good. And there was this idea that, well, healthcare workers just didn't understand modes of transmission. They just didn't understand, why they needed to do what they needed to do. And we did some large-scale surveys of several different categories of healthcare workers, nurses, technicians, funeral directors, emergency medical technicians, corrections workers, whole bunches. And, generally speaking, there certainly were exceptions, but generally speaking, healthcare workers had more than enough knowledge. But they knew why they needed to do what they needed to do, and they knew how they were supposed to do what they needed to do, but they didn't do what they needed to do. And I think the problem was that the training that they had been exposed to just didn't get them into the initiation and maintenance or initiation and adherence stages. And so if we look at what I call best practices training here, which is training that's focusing on behavioral capability and also focusing on interaction and training engagement and so forth, we expand the scope, and we certainly get into the initiation stage, and we generally do cover issues of self-efficacy and facilitating conditions with that kind of training. But still, even with perhaps what would be the best training, we're still not necessarily tapping into the adherence stage. And I make the argument that the long-term adherence, long-term maintenance is really more an organizational issue than it is a training issue. Next slide, training and personal protective equipment compliance. This is a little bit redundant. I think I pretty much covered this slide. I might want to point out the second bullet. And what we often see is the correlation between the number of training hours and compliance is often not very, very strong. It's a fairly weak correlation. part of that weak correlation, I think, is attributable to the kind of training that's done. I would like to think, and I think there's some evidence, that more sophisticated training focusing on behavioral capability and engagement is going to increase that correlation. But still, that correlation is probably not going to be very high with long-term compliance without really factoring in the context or the organizational environment that's involved. So, bottom line, training is important, but it's not going to be enough. We hear a lot these days, and even in the healthcare arena a little bit, we hear a lot about the use of behavior-based safety, the use of reinforcement strategies or feedback and compliance strategies to boost compliance with safe work practices, including PPE use. And I think reinforcing compliance, providing feedback on performance can improve compliance. But I think we have to be cautious in a couple of respects. One is that kind of approach works best for very simple behaviors. Very simple behaviors and behaviors that are frequently performed or behaviors that have to be always performed. And in many healthcare situations, it's not that simple. But use of reinforcement and feedback can be very effective in some situations. We also need to be aware that when we use reinforcement or reinforcers of one kind or another, when those reinforcers are removed, behavior is going to go back to baseline. And that's actually consistent with operant theory. To say that you control a behavior with a reinforcer means that when you withdraw that reinforcer, that behavior changes. And from a common sense point of view, that doesn't make sense to a lot of people. They sort of think, well, I'm going to reinforce something for a while and establish a behavior, and then once that behavior is established, I don't need the reinforcer anymore. Well, in most cases, unless you've really changed the environment substantially, when you withdraw that reinforcer, the behavior is going to diminish, or it's going to go back to baseline. Or in some cases, it's going to boomerang, and it's going to be worse than it was before when the reinforcer is gone. And I guess the last bullet on that slide says, well, the use of reinforcement can be susceptible to gaming. And what I'm saying there is that people will sort of figure out how to get the reinforcers. And I did come across a study. It was a small-scale study that was done with physicians. And somehow, I guess if they washed their hands or something, you may be more familiar with the study than I am, but if they washed their hands or something like that, they got a coupon to get a cup of Starbucks. And these guys, you know, or mostly guys, started gaming the system so they could get as many coupons for cups of Starbucks as they wanted. So reinforcement operant approaches have their place, and they can be very useful, and they can be very effective, but they need to be used with care and caution, and they need to be used in the appropriate way in appropriate situations. And in healthcare, some of our situations and some of our people we're working with, it may not be the best way to go. Okay, talk a little bit more about safety climate. This slide is labeled safety climate. The first bullet, I think, is something I want to talk about a little bit. I gave a definition of safety climate before as the relative importance of safety within a workplace or within an organization. I think a couple things to think about here, without sort of getting too researchy, is when we talk about a climate, we talk about shared perceptions. And so if you want to assess the safety climate in your organization, you might ask people in a variety of different ways, you know, how important is safety, or how important is safety in a particular instance, and so forth and so forth. And you might say, well, the mean level of importance is a measure of safety climate. And You know, I would argue that it's probably not, because what's really important is the extent to which those perceptions are shared across people. So it's the homogeneity of response that's really indicative of the safety climate, more than simply the level of the response. If you say you have a strong safety climate, what you're really saying is that there's a high degree of agreement within my organization about the importance of safety. And in practical application, we sometimes ignore that sort of shared side of it. And that's an important part. Another factor is this idea that, well, it's not just the importance of safety when it's all said and done. It's the importance of safety relative to other goals and objectives within the organization. You know, because you can ask people, you know, we did a study in in railroads, is safety important? And of course it is. But is safety important relative to productivity, relative to getting an engine out on the line, out of the shop and back on the line? And when you start asking people about that, then you see that, well, you know, safety is not always priority one. You can say that safety's job one or safety first, but it isn't usually that simple. If we really want to know about safety climate, we ask people about the relative importance of safety in comparison to other important goals or objectives of the organization. In a healthcare setting, well, how important is safety, is worker safety compared to patient safety? How important is worker safety compared to patient satisfaction? And it gets more complicated. Moving down on this slide, management commitment is generally considered to be probably the most important dimension of safety climate. How committed is management to safety within the organization? Different studies of safety climate will show different combinations of factors, but you will seldom see management commitment not there, not part of those factors. It's, you know, generally speaking, it's usually the most important factor when we start doing some analysis of the contributing factors. Management commitment, too, is really more enacted policies and procedures as opposed to formal policies and procedures. It's not so much what you say, it's really what you do. An organization can have all kinds of safety policies and procedures and all kinds of pronouncements, but it's really the actions that go with the words that drive climate perception. It's really about behavior outcome expectations within an environment. And it's really what you do rather than what you say. I don't want to get too abstract about this, but something else to think about is that safety is a social exchange process. And it's an exchange relationship between the organization and an individual or a supervisor and an individual. And it's about perceptions of the supportiveness of the organization. And what social exchange theory tells us is that there's a certain reciprocity within that exchange relationship. If you perceive that your organization or your department or your supervisor is doing more for you, in this case, in the arena of safety, then most people, most of the time, are going to do more for their supervisor or their organization in the realm of safety. And if you feel that the organization isn't doing much for you, and again, it's not so much reality as it's your subjective perceptions, then you're not going to do much for the organization. And then the other thing about safety climate that's very popular today is the idea that it's a leading indicator of safety performance. And it is. I mean, the evidence is pretty strong. I mean, if you want to take the temperature of your organization with respect to safety, safety climate is a way to do it. Because most of our measures of safety performance are after the fact. When we think about injuries, frequency rates, severity rates, incidence rates, whatever you want to call them, those are really lagging indicators. They're after the fact. And we have relatively few leading indicators in safety, but safety climate is one to think about. I guess I need to move on to the next slide. I guess I don't need to spend a whole lot of time on this slide, but I would want to point out that the knowledge base on safety climate is certainly not complete or unanimous by any stretch of the imagination. We have some different definitions. We have some different models in terms of what are the dimensions, key dimensions of safety climate. We don't know as much about, well, how do we build safety climate? You know, what are the antecedents of safety climate? And we don't have a lot of research on safety climate interventions. You know, how do you improve safety climate? I guess if you put me on the spot and say, well, okay, well, what do you say? Well, what I say probably is actions that show management support and actions that build employee perceptions of organizational support, those, based on what we know today, those are probably the best ways to boost safety. Doing inspections and audits and so forth are certainly important, and it can be extremely beneficial, but a lot of it is how you do it and how you communicate what you do and what happens after you do it. Those are the types of things that indicate management's true commitment and management's true priority to safety. And it also is what shapes people's perceptions about, well, how important is safety in this organization? And if I behave unsafely, what's going to happen to me? You know, or if I behave unsafely under certain circumstances, what's going to happen to me? Again, thinking about people having a very active information processing role. They're thinking about these things at one level or another all the time, and things change. Okay, a few more things. Again, if we want to build safety climate, another way to think about it is in terms of, I call this a multi-level perspective, and, you know, statistically that's what we would call it, a multi-level perspective, but we're talking really about macro organizational factors in micro organizational factors. And it is useful when we think about compliance behavior, in this case PPE compliance. You know, what are the macro organizational factors and what are the micro organizational factors? Go to the next slide, some examples of what would be within the category of macro factors and what would be in the category of micro factors. When it's all said and done, I think, if we're trying to improve our safety performance in trying to improve personal protective equipment usage, we probably get more bang for the buck by focusing in on the micro-organizational factors. And I want to be careful here because somebody might be looking at the slide and say, well, wait a minute, DeJoy. You just said that top management support or management commitment was the most important factor. And at one level, that's true, because if you don't have it, you know, you're not going to be able to do anything at the micro level anyway. And so you got to have the top management commitment and support. But in terms of what's really visible at the front line of an organization or on the shop floor, or however you want to describe it, or on the hospital floor, what's really most visible there are the micro-organizational factors. I mean, these are really the factors that form everyday reality for most employees. And much of the way in which we show management support is through the micro organizational factors. What's going on at the macro level is very important, but it's not as visible, or it's not as much a part of reality. We've done some studies in different areas where we've really actively tried to engage top management, and we can, in some cases, get them engaged, but there's no trickle down. There's no trickle down to the front line, and so what's going on at the upper level is for some reason or another, it's just not trickling down. And we talked about the importance of perceptions and subjective evaluations, and what's happening is that nothing's happening down at the front line. So I guess if you're going to think about intervention and think about change, my bet would be to focus more at the micro organizational level than at the macro organizational level. Keeping in mind, not being too naive, keeping in mind that, well, if you don't have the top management support and the resources, you're not going to be able to do anything anyways at the micro level. But the reality is really more at the lower level, the front line. Okay, got some conclusions to leave you with, because I think I'm getting near my end of my time. Okay, personal protective equipment. Okay, it's part of a comprehensive hazard control strategy. And I modified this slide since I sent them to Paul, and I now have PART in capital letters. You know, it's part of a comprehensive hazard control strategy. It is very seldom, if ever, the key piece of the hazard control strategy, or the only piece of the hazard control strategy. PPE compliance, multi-component, interactive behavioral process, emphasizing the word interactive. I now have that in caps. And then the third bullet, workers actively make judgments of personal risk on an ongoing basis. And underlining actively and an ongoing basis. Different factors, different variables are important at different stages of compliance. And these factors, as they emerge as important, these ultimately are the leverage points. If you want to think about leverage points in this stage process, or sort of sweet spots to hit with actions or interventions, that's a way to think about it. The factors that emerge as you progress through the stages, those are ultimately our leverage points for intervention. Okay, training is important, but it needs to go beyond basic knowledge, and we certainly need more than a blaming train mentality. Facilitating enabling conditions, workplace climate, enhance the transfer of training. And underlining transfer of training. If we're talking about long-term performance, long-term safety performance, if we want the training to actually be realized in practice, we need to create conditions which make that happen, make that easy to happen, and in some cases make it impossible not to happen. And then again, as we were just talking about, micro-organizational factors may be the initial priority for climate-related intervention. And the climate-related intervention, I think, is sort of getting us to the point where certain behaviors become the accepted way of doing things. It's just how we do things in this organization. And to get to that point, there's going to need to be a lot of micro-organizational analysis and initiations to get us to that point. And the last point is that quite often participatory and involvement strategies can be more effective than sort of a more top-down approach. And I know in many work situations, and I think in many healthcare situations, it's very, very hard to spend much time on participatory and involvement types of strategies. But I think maybe particularly in healthcare, those strategies can be very important and may indeed be worth investing in. And I understand that how hard that can be. The evidence base is not extensive in healthcare on those strategies, but I think it could be very important. So that's really what I have to say about why people don't use PPE. I hope some of the information has been helpful. I hope I haven't been sort of too abstract or too academic about this, and that there's some things you can take away from the presentation today that you can use in your work. And I very much appreciate being asked to make this presentation, and I hope it's helpful in some way. Thank you very much.
Professor DeJoy, thank you very much. And the great thing about the teleclass education program, or one of the great things, is that even if you were abstract and we didn't catch it the first time around, the recording is going to be posted online forever, so we can listen to it again and again and again.
I forgot about that part.
Listen, thank you very, very much. It's almost difficult, isn't it? Because if some of the most important activities are at the micro level, at the where the rubber hits the road, and yet those can't be done or are ineffective unless the macro support is there, the administration support is there, then you wonder, where do you start? You know, doing the micro things is easy. You can get your teeth into those. But advocating in the executive offices, I should think, could be tremendously frustrating and almost mind-numbingly painful.
It can be. It isn't always. One thing that I've noticed in some of our practice is that the top management support is there, and when you really run into problems is mid-management. And I guess I'm thinking now of you know, big organizations that might be, you know, national or even international in scope. But what we have found is that top management, you know, might really be talking the talk, and they might even be walking the walk. But when you get down to the mid-management level or the regional level or however you want to call it, their reality is different there, and there's a disconnect there. And so where it falls down is not so much at the front line or not so much at the top line, it's the middle line. And that can be, if you have that buy-in there or understanding there, you can really have problems.
If I can put you on the spot for a sec, can you think of any organizations off the top of your head that are doing it well in terms of getting their staff to wear PPE in a very organized and cohesive way?
I don't think I have enough day-to-day familiarity with what's really going on out there to be able to make that statement. I do know that the Joint Commission is looking at right now collecting sort of best practices in this area, and going to be doing some kind of an evaluation project, research project, to sort of assess examples of best practices and to sort of evaluate them. And I think that could be potentially quite interesting.
Good. Thank you all for your attendance today and your attention, and I look forward to speaking with you again very soon. And Professor DeJoy, thank you for a really well presented and well prepared teleclass lecture. I'm very pleased with it, and I thank you, sir, very, very much.
I enjoyed it. I hope it was helpful.
Until we meet again, everyone, goodbye.